Among the thousands of interesting and historic relics sent on loan to the Great British Festival in London this year is a tall silver cup from the United States. When it was fashioned by expert British silversmiths in 1851, it was said to have cost 100 guineas, or about $500 in our money. And some Britishers allowed, "That's too much for a mug without any bottom, but it will be good to look at as the years go by." But the conservative Britishers haven't had a chance to look at their bottomless mug for 100 years, because after we won that cup in the most famous yacht race of all time, it has been safely tucked away in the vaults of Tiffany Company, where the New York Yacht Club put it for safekeeping. I'm referring, of course, to America's Cup, won from the British in the never-to-be-forgotten yacht race of 100 years ago. As this is the anniversary of that great sporting event, the papers and magazines have had several mentions of the Yacht America, and banks and museums have had special exhibitions. The nautically minded State Street Trust Company here in Boston had a fine scale model of the America on display, and etchings, lithographs, and actual photographs of the America have been on view at the Peabody Museum in Salem. Life magazine had an article a few weeks ago called $20 Million for Revenge, dealing as it did with the various attempts of English sportsmen to get the cup back to Britain. And in the August issue of Rudder magazine, the eminent yacht designer L. Francis Herrishoff of Marblehead had a swell story about the Yankees who designed and built the America. Behind the building and sailing of this famous American schooner yacht is a fascinating story. And here briefly are the details. In the year 1850, when all Britain was getting ready for their great jubilee, and workmen were hustling to finish the Crystal Palace to hold interesting exhibits from all over the world, a London merchant wrote to a friend in New York as follows. "Inasmuch as we will be holding yacht races in connection with our great celebration next summer, why don't you get some American sportsmen to enter a Yankee yacht?" And then he added, "If no one American cares to assume the expense of building a boat and sailing her over to compete, maybe a group of Yankees would underwrite the venture." Now, if that Britisher had his tongue in cheek and thought that any American-built yacht would be so soundly beaten across the pond that we'd be the laughing stock of the world, he got the surprise of his life. This wasn't the first challenge Britain had flung in our direction, and as usual, it was accepted with typical Yankee enthusiasm. Mr. John Cox Stevens, Commodore of the New York Yacht Club, got five of his yachting friends to form a syndicate. Then they looked around for experts who could design and build a boat which would beat the pants off our British cousins. Down at the foot of 11th and 12th Streets in New York on East River were the offices of the Steers brothers and the shipyard, a boat builder, William H. Brown. The Steers boys had designed the popular pilot schooners and packets, and neighbor Brown had built them, along with sloops, barks, tugs, and ocean liners. So down to 12th Street, Mr. Stevens went, and he told Messrs. Steers and Brown all about the British challenge, and he asked them what they could do for him. George Steers says, "I know just what you want, a smart schooner yacht, along the lines of my pilot schooner Mary Taylor, which incidentally had the sharpest bow in New York and was very fast." Mr. Steers continued, "I might even suggest a sharper bow and a bit more rake to the mast." And Mr. Stevens interrupted to ask, "All right, Steers, what'll she cost us?" 31-year-old George Steers drummed on his desk, grinned, and said, "If the yacht we build for you fellas wins over there, you'll have to pay us $30,000. But if she's beaten in English waters by any vessel her size, you won't owe us one red cent." The contract was drawn up and signed. This was November 1850. And they promised the new schooner for the following April. But as frequently happens in boat building, there were unavoidable delays. And besides, George Brown wasn't the kind of a shipbuilder who could be hurried. So it was the first week in May, 1851, when the schooner was finally finished. Time was getting so short, the syndicate called on Brown and Steers and said impatiently, "I don't think you fellows realize how far behind you are on schedule. Queen Victoria has opened the exposition, and the races will be starting in a few weeks. We'll have to have trial runs, change the rig, get a crew, and the yacht that you promised us hasn't even been launched. Now, here's a proposition for you. You get that schooner into the water immediately, and we'll pay you $20,000 cash, and we'll take her off your hands without even a trial." The deal was closed, and a couple of days later, the schooner yacht, which was destined to make history in more ways than one, slid into the East River, and as not one of her sponsors was on hand to see her launched, it remained for boat builder George Brown to christen her America. It had already been decided to sail her over to Le Havre for final rigging, but naturally Stevens wanted to try her out, and he was flabbergasted when his own yacht, Mariah, sailed circles around the new America. "Well, what's so surprising about that?" said Brown. "Your Mariah's a sloop, and she's bigger. You won't have no trouble over there if you get the sails I've specified and keep 'em flat." English sails in those days were loosely woven and billowed, whereas the America's canvas was to be tight woven and set flat to give greater efficiency in working to windward. Commodore Stevens, who was to command America as soon as she reached England, booked passage on a steamer so he'd be at Le Havre ahead of the yacht to arrange for docking and overhaul. The skipper, chosen to take America across the Atlantic on her maiden voyage, was Captain Richard Brown, a bewhiskered old sea dog. And just before they sailed, he barked to the crew, "If any of you white-livered pups wants to go ashore, now's the time to say so. This ain't going to be in a Sunday school picnic, mates. This is going to be tough." Well, it was so gosh darn rough, even Captain Brown got green around the gills. And by the time they reached Nantucket, half of the crew were in their bunks, wishing to high heaven they had gone ashore. It rained torrents, and the schooner rolled and pitched. Then a rip-snotting gale tore her sails into shreds. Then they were becalmed for 5 days. Then another gale struck, and everyone but the Steers brothers was deathly seasick. James Steers kept a log of that notable crossing, and you can read it today at the New York Yacht Club. But most of the notes that he put into his little book were about what they had to eat and drink on the way over. On one of the stormiest days, Jimmy wrote in his diary, "Just had a fine dinner of veal pot pie with Indian fritters and claret sauce, but only three of us was able to get to the table." Well, they made port in Le Havre on July 21st, having crossed the Atlantic in 20 days and 6 hours. Commodore Stevens was waiting at the government dry dock where the America was quickly berthed. Her topside was given a fresh coat of paint, she had her bottom scraped, and the new tight-woven sails were broken out and put on. Then Commodore Stevens took the helm, and away they sailed for Cowes, England. Now, on the way up to Cowes, they met the fast-sailing British cutter, Laverick. She appeared to be itching to race America. Stevens shouted, "Let her go, boys!" And away America went, beating the British yacht by over half an hour. And you know, that so scared those English sportsmen, they positively refused to meet the America in a race. Commodore Stevens sent challenge after challenge, but he got no takers at any price. And finally, he entered the schooner America in the Royal Yacht Squadron's regatta, which was held on Friday, August the 22nd. This race was over the regular squadron course around the Isle of Wight, 53 miles in Trichy, and the prize was the big silver cup I mentioned earlier, which had cost $500. On race day, Cowes, England, the spectators. They lined the esplanade, leaned out of windows, clung to the very rooftops, and all who could got into boats or aboard the excursion steamers. More than 100 flag-decked yachts were anchored in the harbor, and in front of Queen Victoria's summer residence, Osborne House, the royal yacht Albert and Victoria was getting up steam. Betting was quite brisk, but only a few Englishmen believed the America had a Chinaman's chance. And when it became known that Stevens would race against 6 fast schooners and 7 sloops, the reporters said the America was jinxed. One scribe declaring, "Why, she hasn't got a ghost of a chance. Sailing on a Friday with a crew of 13 and then entering a race with 13 against her on another Friday? Why, not even a Yankee can beat a jinx like that." And for a few minutes, it looked as though he was right. The starting gun boomed at 10 o'clock. And before the sun cleared away, all the yachts but one made a good getaway. The unlucky laggard was the America. The Gypsy Queen, with all her sails set, quickly took the lead, followed by the Volante, Arrow, Beatrice, and Aurora. Commodore Stevens finally got underway under mainsail, small gaff topsail, fore staysail, and jib, while his 13 opponents had every square inch of canvas crammed on the regulations would allow. 10 minutes passed, then 12, then 13, and suddenly America came to life, and surging ahead, she overtook and passed all the other yachts except the Gypsy Queen and the Aurora. At 10:30, Gypsy Queen forged ahead, giving Commodore Stevens a chance to do his stuff. And when the wind freshened at 10:45, America leaped ahead. But Volante was right on her tail and gaining every minute. Shortly after this, Volante passed the America and took the lead. As the yachts rounded Norman's Land's buoy, the wind was blowing more steadily, and America could now show what she could do. and with her closely woven sails, as flat and tight as a drumhead, she lifted away from the other yachts, including Volante, which she passed in the freshening breeze. And to show that he was a good sport, Commodore Stevens dropped his jib, as if to say to the boys on the Volante, "See, I'll give you fellas a break." But at 1:50, an ominous crack was heard aboard the America, and her big jib-boom snapped in two, and at the same time, the wind died down. It took a quarter of an hour to repair the damage, and the Aurora, in the meantime, made the most of it. Looking backward, Stevens saw that two of the yachts were in trouble. A third was standing by, while several others had already quit and were headed back toward Cowes. Stevens' only concern at this moment was the little Aurora, booming along toward them just a few miles astern. Several large excursion steamers had proceeded to Alum Bay to greet the first white sail to round the chalk and limestone pillars known as the Needles. And cruising smoothly up ahead was the Royal Steam Yacht, bearing Queen Victoria, her husband, and a party of English nobility. The warm August afternoon dragged on, and then suddenly, at 6:10, a great shout went up from the excursion boats, as around the Needles came America, leaping like a greyhound with the little Aurora right behind it. Now, you wouldn't expect a jockey to pull up his mount and salute in a steeplechase just because royalty was watching. But as the America came abreast the royal yacht, Commodore Stevens lowered his ensign and doffed his cap. And instantly, every man aboard the American yacht stood at attention with uncovered head as they passed the Queen. Queen Victoria, an ardent yachting enthusiast herself, was much impressed by this gallant gesture. And turning to one of the sailors, she asked, "Who came in second?" "Your Majesty," the man replied, "there is no second." The victorious America crossed the finish line 24 minutes before the Aurora, and 3 hours and 46 minutes before the next yacht. The others didn't count. It was a smashing, clean-cut victory for Commodore Stevens and the New York Yacht Club, and also a victory for the Steers brothers and William H. Brown, who had built the schooner. Next day, the Queen let it be known that should the America be in the vicinity of her summer residence, Osborne House, she'd be glad to pay the yacht a visit. And much has been written about that celebrated social call. Queen Victoria was welcomed aboard the America by Commodore Stevens and Colonel James Hamilton, son of Alexander Hamilton. And when the Queen was taken down into the galley, she ran her lace handkerchief along one of the shelves and seemed surprised and pleased to find it spotless. Mr. Harishoff says in his article in Rudder, "Captain Richard Brown behaved pretty good while royalty was on board. But when the party went below, he did tell the Prince Consort to wipe your feet on that mat there at the foot of the companionway." I guess that must have amused the Queen, for she sent the bluff old Yankee skipper a handsome gold compass with a note saying, "I hope you'll keep this as bright and shining as you keep the America." Well, folks, that in brief is the story of the great yacht race of 1851. And as I said, America's Cup is now on loan at the 1951 British Festival. But don't think this is the end of the story. The yacht America was destined to play an important role in the American Navy. And I shall have the details of that story for you next week.